Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
You don't really manage it. What you do is you just kind of put your head down and go and just pray that it works.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Pete Gash of LaSalle Men's Basketball. Pete has an incredible story. He had a quick rise in the profession, going from Division II student assistant to GA for Tom Crean, becoming a Division I assistant coach at the age of 24, to working for Billy Donovan, to getting back on the road at Chattanooga.
And really, everything was great for Pete. Everything professionally in his life was going right. And at that time is when his wife was diagnosed with cancer. And Pete really opens up about how he dealt with that in the middle of the season, and was able to be there for his wife and help her through such a trying time and still juggle the responsibilities of his job. And then after that, Pete went up to UMass and was on staff there before they had to make a change and let go of their entire coaching staff, all three assistant coaches. And Pete talks about how he dealt with that very public and embarrassing firing, which really drove him out of the profession, or at least to the brinks of getting out of the profession, before some close friends of his dragged him back in and gave him renewed purpose and passion for what he's doing. Really a great conversation, really inspirational, and very important, you know, for people to hear and be able to keep things in perspective. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. Please write us a review and subscribe, and please follow along with what we're doing at risingcoaches.com. Okay, before we jump into today's podcast, I want to talk to you briefly about the Rising Coaches membership. You know, so many people ask, what is it? What do you get? Will this help me get a job? That's the million-dollar question. A lot of times people hit us up when they need job advice and asking for help. And look, we're happy to give advice and help anytime we can, whether you're a member or not. And we can't guarantee that signing up for a membership is going to get you a job. We don't want to get into that. But what we can guarantee is if you do sign up, there's some tremendous content on our member site, and we are constantly bringing in new coaches and guests to speak to our group. So we really feel strongly that it'll help you with your development. If you want to meet coaches in the profession from all different levels, which I always strongly advise, you never know who can help you in this business, both personally and professionally. I can guarantee you'll have a lot of opportunities to create genuine relationships with those people and different coaches that you would have never met otherwise. And if you want to be a part of a community of coaches that's there to bounce ideas off of, help you, support you, then please, I think Rising Coaches is something that you'd be interested in. So if you think that this is something that you can benefit from, check out our website, risingcoaches.com/membership. It's only $120 a year, which is $10 a month to be a part of it. That's an annual fee, and we hope you'll consider being a part of our community of now over 500 coaches, which is awesome, in just 5 months of having the membership program open. So grateful for everyone that's a part of it, and we hope that you will consider joining. Pete, thanks for being on the podcast, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, Adam. Thanks for having me. Got a lot of time these days with the coronavirus to sit and talk.
Yeah, that's what everyone's got now, right? A lot of time.
But as much time as we have, we're also busy. We're at home with our families. If anyone has kids, you know, they're waking you up every morning. So it's a different dynamic than you're used to when you get up and leave and go get a coffee and go to work.
Yeah, I got a head start on all you guys because I started working from home a year ago. So I'm a little bit ahead of the curve, knowing how to manage the little ones and still get things done.
You might need to send us some clinic notes on that.
Yeah, no question. That would probably be more valuable than anything we do coaching-wise.
No question.
All right. Well, first of all, we've known each other for years, but I don't think we really ever put it together that you started as a student assistant at Lynn, which is in South Florida, in the Sunshine State Conference, the exact same years that I was at University of Tampa, which is in the exact same D2 league in Florida. So we had some battles back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys were good. You guys ran a lot of the three out, two in. You had two really good big guys. You were throwing to those guys all the time. And, you know, we had some really good guards, and we spread the floor, and we shot a lot of threes. But I remember, people don't understand, there's not a lot of people. There's not a lot of film of those high-level D2 games, but there was some competitiveness going on in that league at that time.
That league was – the Sunshine State Conference was – especially then. I'm sure it's still good now. I don't watch it as much, but – I mean, it's as good as a lot of like low major leagues, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Hall of Fame coaches everywhere.
Everywhere. And guys that have been there and have really good systems. And when I was there, we could live scout. So, yep. Adam, I would like go on like Tuesday night. I would like finish class, finish practice. And we'd drive over to Tampa or we'd drive up to St. Leo.
Yeah.
And we'd live scout the game. Because at that time, you could only get two or three, you could only request two or three footages of that team. So we'd request the game film, and then we'd have to go live scout other games. So we were in the car all the time, live scouting, going to St. Leo, going to Tampa, going to Rollins, just to watch these teams. We'd sit behind their bench. We'd get their play calls. I mean, we didn't have a day during the season where we weren't recruiting or live scouting.
Yeah, yeah, me too. And I'm sure you remember, like, you would request a film, and you'd probably have to go, like, pick it up, meet the coach from the other team somewhere in the middle. Meet them on the side of the road at a Wendy's or something,
in Yeehaw Junction. We had a spot in Yeehaw Junction that we used to drive to pick up the film and then turn around and come back. And like, I was trying to balance school at the time too. And it would be like, I'd get done class at like 9, I'd go drive an hour and 20 minutes, pick up the film, come back, practice, and then go back out either with someone recruiting or live scouting that night. Like it was a nuts time for me in college doing all that. But it kept me out of some trouble, because South Florida can get you in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, for sure. I believe it. Well, crazy that we've never had these conversations till now, but I'm glad we finally connected the dots. For me, it was like an unbelievable experience, you know, getting thrown in the deep end and getting to be hands-on at such a young age where, like, you know, if you did that, if you're a manager at a Division I school, you're not doing that. Maybe you're around a lot more coaches and bigger staffs and meet more people, but you're not getting to do those type of things.
Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest thing I took away from working for Scott McMillan. Was he was 28 years old at the time when I went there, and he only had a graduate assistant working for him. So when I told him that I wanted to coach and I wanted to get into it, his eyes got big, and he threw me right in the fire. And like that first week, like, we were doing drills with the guys, we were doing you know, offensive execution stuff. He was asking me to break down practice, and you just get thrown into it, and it just becomes part of your habits. And, you know, before you know it, you're acting like a full-time Division II assistant coach, and you're taking, you know, college algebra 101 at 8 a.m. So
exactly.
It was great. I think it's a great experience. And I wish that more young guys would try and do it, because I don't think that there's any way to simulate some of the hands-on stuff that you get to do, from recruiting to scouting to practice to coaching to all that stuff that you get to do at the Division II level.
Yeah, no question. And I got really lucky, because as soon as I graduated, Mark Olson, who was the assistant, I don't know if you remember Ole, but Ole hooked me up with a job at Central Florida Community College. So I was really fortunate to get that opportunity. It sounds like you got you went a different route, but you got a great opportunity too right out of college. At LaSalle.
Yeah.
How did that situation present itself?
So I was really nervous graduating, because I was doing all this stuff and I wanted to get a job. And I was like, if I'm doing all this, I want to try to get paid for it. So I had Coach McMillan line me up with a couple of junior colleges, and I thought I was going to get a job at Santa Fe and Gulf Coast Junior College at the time. And I was emailing all Division I head coaches up in Philadelphia, New York area where my family lives. And I wrote an email to Dr. John Giannini. He liked it. He said, come up, let's meet. I drove up from Florida up to Philadelphia. I met with him, and we just started talking basketball. And he wanted to put the flex in at the time. So at the time, Al Skinner was running the flex at Boston College, and Bruce Pearl was at Tennessee running the flex. And one of the things that I did at Lynn was I VHS recorded every game that was on television for 3 years. So I had this whole library of VHS tapes. So I just decided to bring those tapes up with me to put them at my house in Philadelphia. And I had all those in the car. So when I was talking to Giannini, we were talking about what he wanted to do with his offense. I said, I've got these tapes. You want to watch them? So I went to the car, got the VHS tapes, and we just started watching film all day during my interview. And he ended up calling me a couple of days later and offering me the job. But all those games that I was recording on ESPN, ESPN2 on your VHS player, they ended up paying off really, really, really big for me to get me my first Division I job.
And I don't know Dr. Giannini at all, but I've heard nothing but like amazing things about him. Was that your experience with him as well?
Yeah, one of the best people you're ever going to come across in basketball. Just like a good, solid human being. You know, really did an unbelievable job at LaSalle. Went to a Sweet 16 at LaSalle, and what he was able to do there was very impressive. And I still talk to him all the time. Talk to him anything basketball related, I call him for. And he's a great guy and was a great person for me to get my feet wet with in Division I.
So, what were you? Were you a GA there at LaSalle, or what was your title?
No, I was a video coordinator. I was making $1,200 a month.
Yeah,
living at home, so made it work. Yeah.
And you're there for a year, is that right? Before you go to Indiana, with Tom Crean. And that was Crean's first year, right?
Yep. Crean's first year. So what happened was, when I was at Lynn, I would go out on the road every summer recruiting. The Division II, you know, you're a student assistant, they let you go. So I was going out on the road and I was just chasing guys around on the road in Disney. And me and Coach Crean just kept on crossing each other's paths. And he asked me what I was doing, what my situation was. I told him I was going to LaSalle. I said, I'm coming from Division II, spending the whole entire year, you know, going to Disney, watching games, going to different AAU events. So when he got the job at Indiana, I wrote him a note and just said, congratulations, would love to connect with you and, you know, love speaking with you last summer. And he called me and said, I got a flight for you next weekend. Come up here. Let's do an interview. So I took the flight up there. It was during the Adidas May Classic. That was held at Indiana. I watched games for 2 days, spent 2 days with him, and then he offered me the graduate assistant spot for our first year at Indiana, which we were 6-26. So that was an experience in itself. But, you know, again, it was just hustling from the Division II level, which led me to meet Coach Crean.
I'm fascinated by, like, how people build programs and, like, what they're doing and focusing on. Like when they first get there, what did you like learn from Crean watching him kind of build Indiana up and what was he doing and focusing on that year one?
Yeah. First of all, that year was unlike anything. I think there should be a 30 for 30. And I think if you talk to Benny Seltzer and Tim Buckley and Brian Baroni and Julian Schwartz and guys that were on that staff, like we can all tell you, like it was completely unlike probably anything in college basketball. We were playing walk-ons and managers in the Big Ten that year because our roster was so depleted. And we didn't have a lot of wiggle room. So we just kind of took anyone that was out there and we saved scholarships for the next year. So we were really bad and we were playing guys that had no business playing in the Big Ten. But what Coach did that I thought was what set the tone for them to eventually be a Sweet 16 team and be number one in the country was he treated every day like it was a preparation for an NCAA tournament game. You know, like we would be in February and we hadn't won a game in the league and we'd be going through scout like it was the most important thing in the world. And he never let up. And that kind of bled into the culture for how everything was done, from how we organized our video to our recruiting mail outs to camp to everything. And that relentless approach to not let the record determine how hard you work really set the tone for them having some success there in 2-3 years after that miserable, you know, 1-15 season in the league and 6-26 overall.
Yeah, that's really hard to do because I've been on some bad teams now, and you know, when you take loss after loss, like it's hard to come in with that energy and intensity every single day. You know, when you win, it's like a little energy boost. But when none of those wins are coming, you know, that season gets really, really long.
Really long.
Is that just how Crean's wired or what kept him,
you know,
sharp?
I think for him, he had a vision. And I think he wasn't going to let anything get in the way of that vision. And I think that the harder it got, the more energy he brought. And I remember we were getting ready for Penn State at a 12 o'clock game on a Saturday, and we had like a noon practice on a Friday, and like the energy was kind of dropping a little bit. So he just flipped the script up real quick. We started doing some competitive shell stuff, and it got really good. And then we ended it with a charge dive drill, and he threw everyone from the managers to the coaches into the drill, and the energy just completely went through the roof. And I just remember him just not allowing it to drop. And I think it's partially how he's wired, but I also think it's partially like he had this vision of how he wanted it to look, and nothing was going to change it, whether we were hadn't won a game in the Big Ten or we were 500. Like he wasn't gonna cave on it. So that's kind of how I think it's a little bit how he's wired, Adam. But I also think like he wasn't going to let anything get in the way of what he wanted Indiana to be.
Okay. And let me just say now, like, you've got too many stops on your resume, Pete, so we're not going to be able to get to everything. But I do want to touch on the fact that you do go from Indiana to FAU, Florida Atlantic, and you're 24 years old and you're a Division I assistant coach, which is big time. That's, I mean, I'm sure were you the youngest assistant coach in Division I at the time?
Yeah, one of them. I think me and there might have been one other guy, Drexel, that was pretty young at the time.
Did you feel like you knew what you were doing, or did you feel like did you have some days where you're like, man, I don't, you know, what was that transition like at that age?
Honestly, I didn't feel like I had any clue. I was just hustling. I was just watching guys. I mean, I knew who we could get and who we couldn't get, but I didn't know how to get them, you know, and I just thought overdoing everything was the best way to go about it. And, you know, you could be so relentless that you can get someone. But the reality is that sometimes you can be so relentless, you turn them off, you know, and I had to learn that a little bit young, you know, being a young assistant. But I had no idea. I mean, I luckily worked for Coach Jarvis, who had been a big time Division I coach, and his son was on staff and Tim Kaine was on staff. So I had some guys that were older than me that kind of were patient with me. But they knew I wanted to work. They knew I was willing to do anything. So they gave me a couple recruiting cycles to get comfortable. But yeah, I didn't really know. I had to kind of figure it out on the fly and just ask a lot of questions and be really aware of what's going on in the recruiting world.
Yeah, and you worked for like veteran head coaches for like most of the beginning of your career, which I'm sure, you know, like the recruiting thing is one thing, but then there's the on-court piece that you got to figure out, and that takes years sometimes to get comfortable with your voice and find mm-hmm. your voice. But I'm sure it helps to lean on some of those guys like a Tom Crean and a Mike Jarvis and a Dr. Giannini, who had been doing it for years and years and years. Like, were they dominating practice, basically? I would imagine, like, those guys are the main voice in practice.
Yeah, those guys dominate practice. And I think the biggest thing you got to learn when you get the chance to coach is you got to learn, like, what your head coach wants. You know, like, you can't sit there and just coach a practice the way that you want to coach the practice or run a drill the way you want to run a drill. You've got to see what they want and kind of feel them out and pick your spots to coach. Because if you come in there and you're like Rambo ripping and running, they're going to talk to you about it. They're going to let you know that's not how they want it. And you don't want to do that. You want to know what they want and you want to do it how they want it. And that'll help you be able to coach more as you go if you're more aware of how they wanted to get coached.
And you guys have success there at FAU. And then Mike Jarvis retires. You get married, Mike Jarvis retires. How many years were you there? 5 years?
Yeah, I was there 5 years. We won 21 games, won the league championship in 2011, I believe. And then Coach Jarvis retired. I get married in August, and the following March, Coach Jarvis retires. So was sitting there like, what am I going to do? Got a wife, you know, what's next here? And, you know, when you know how hard it is, man, this business, it is hard to stay in. It is very, very hard to stay in this business and find a way to just keep your foot in the door. So I was really worried I wasn't going to be able to have another opportunity to coach. But I was lucky enough to get to Florida where, you know, that was huge being able to work for, you know, a Hall of Fame guy like Coach Donovan. So I really lucked out with that.
Did you just get to know those guys being in the state or how did you make that connection?
Yeah, I got to know all those guys just being in the state. And I think those guys had a good understanding that I was in a tough spot and Coach Jarvis retired and I was still young at the time. And it was late. It was like August, and Oliver Winterbone went to work for the Oklahoma City Thunder and they had a spot. So I just jumped right up there and just started working.
What was your title? Were you video?
I was a video coordinator there. Okay. Yep. So I went from being an assistant for 5 years to a whole different vantage point now, going back to being a sports staff.
Was that hard? I imagine it wasn't as hard because you went there right after they went back-to-back championships, right?
No, I went there right after they went to the Final Four.
Oh, okay. After the Final Four. Okay, okay. Gotcha.
Yep.
So, but still, you know, the program is like at a high. It's Billy Donovan. I know it's hard to go from on the road to like a support staff role. We talk about it a lot on the show, but like, I'm sure because you're working for who you're working for, Billy Donovan, is it a little easier?
Yeah, for me, it was hard because I was so used to being in the mix with everything, you know, and now you come to a team that's coming off of the Final Four and you've got to just really take a seat back. And you got to really just look back and see it from a different vantage point. So that was hard. But what was great was Coach Donovan is one of the most amazing people that you're ever going to come across, you know, not just in basketball, but just in life. Like, he's a great person. He's got no ego. He treats everyone so well. He makes you feel important. And just being around that was easy for me to get comfortable with everyone there. Now, I can't say enough great things about how Coach Donovan ran his program and the people around the program. And a guy that I'm sure you know, Preston Green, was one of the best strength coaches in the country. Like, all those people were there. So it was really easy for me to get comfortable just because of those guys' character.
All right. Talk a little bit more about like what makes Coach Donovan unique and maybe give us like an example or two.
Yeah. So I think what makes Coach Donovan really special is he confronts everything. But in the right way. Like, there's no problem that's going to happen in his program that he's not going to confront. And if he sees an issue, he's going to deal with it right then and there. And that's from how the players treat each other, to how the coaches treat the players, how the players respond to the coaches, to how the staff treats each other. And he's just going to confront all those things. And he's not going to allow anything to fester in his program and become a bigger problem. And that's one of the things that I really loved watching him do, because that season we struggled. We were 500. We lost some really tough games. We got blown out a couple of times, and it was the next day that he was dealing with whatever happened. You know, whether it was how he felt players were acting with each other chemistry wise, or if he felt the staff needed to be more dialed in, like, he was dealing with that. And that's kind of what made him so great. And he did it with such authenticity that you had no other choice but to be completely locked into what he was saying and change. And he's so likable that everyone just wanted to please him. And it's kind of what makes that him such a good coach, is that he's got so many people that are bought into him as a person and want to be like him. But it gave him this aura that you didn't want to let down.
So when you say like he confronts everything, I'm thinking like abrasive, but it sounds like that's not really, I'm sure it could be that way at times, but that sounds like that's not really exactly how he confronted.
No, it's not. It's more just talking, you know. Hey, listen, I don't like what you said there. I want to just make sure that we're on the same page. Like, let's clear that up. Or, hey, we need to get more dialed in with our scouting, and you know, we need to make sure that we're blitzing this pick and roll, and let's all get on the same page and do it. You know, and he was so good at that, and it wasn't abrasive. It was authentic and it was genuine. And that's what made everyone be able to change so quickly.
Okay. So also when you're there, you work with Matt McCall. Mm-hmm. Was Matt an assistant at that time?
Yeah. So Matt was an assistant at Florida at the time. He was an assistant at FAU when I first got to FAU. So I had known him for a while.
So you guys are really close. And he gets the Chattanooga job. And you go with him, right, as an assistant?
Mm-hmm.
And you're coming into Chattanooga. It's Will Wade had just left, so they had some success. And, all right, now is where you hit, like, some real adversity, because is this where your wife gets sick?
Yeah. So we got to Chattanooga. We inherited Will Wade's team, which was absolutely stacked. And we had to really manage those guys and get them to buy in. And we had a great staff. We had Jesse Bopp and Reggie Witherspoon that were so good at just managing the guys. And Matt and I were very close, and we had a really good relationship. We knew the system that we wanted to put in from Florida, and it translated really quick. And we won 29 games, and we went to the NCAA tournament in our first year. And it was, we were on top. You know what I mean? Like, we felt like we had all the answers. We felt like we were going, you know, to places that Chattanooga's never been. And that off season, Coach Bopp left to go to New Mexico, and Reggie left to go to Canisius to be the head coach. So it was just me and Matt, and we ended up bumping up our director of operations, and we hired someone from UNC Wilmington. And it was just kind of a whole different aura that was around the program, you know, and one of the hardest things to do is win after winning. So we're in the summer there, and my wife gets diagnosed with cancer. She gets diagnosed with stage 2 cancer in her throat. So we're on the road recruiting the last week in July, and she calls me from Florida, where she was staying with her mom, and says, something's not looking good in my throat. I'm going to go get it checked out. And then she calls me a day later and says, it's cancer. So when that happened, Adam, everything that we had just done the year previously at Chattanooga for me personally went completely out the window. And I just went into focusing on my wife and making sure she's okay. And we just kind of had to formulate a plan to get her treatment and get her what she needed in the midst of trying to finish up recruiting, get this team prepared to win, all that stuff. And it was probably the hardest thing I've ever been through, was trying to make sure that my wife had everything that she needed to have to be safe and stay alive, and also not completely give up on my job. And I was lucky enough to have a lot of good support there, which helped me be able to give her the treatment that she needed, get her where she needed to go, and also try and help coach the team, which was very challenging. And in that time, Adam, you completely lose sight of yourself. Like, you don't take care of yourself. You don't worry about yourself. You're completely dialed into getting your wife healthy, making sure your baby's okay, and trying to do anything that you can to help the team, you know, win games.
Yeah. How did you juggle that? Like, I know, like, when I got to SEMO and got my first Division I assistant job, my wife and I were going through like a really tough time. And, you know, I had to divide my attention between like making sure she was okay and my mm-hmm. job. And so like mm-hmm. every second of the day, it felt like was taken up between like my family. And as soon as I got a second and made sure my family was good for just like 10 minutes, okay, can mm-hmm. I make this recruiting call? Can I check in on mm-hmm. one of our guys? Can I run to the gym for 2 hours for practice and then get right back? You know, like, that's hard. You know, like, how yeah. did you manage that?
Well, the thing that you, and I'm sure you probably went through this too, is you, because you're balancing so many different things, you, something's got to give. And the thing that gives in those situations is yourself. So for me, we'd wake up at, we got her to a treatment place in Knoxville, which was an hour and 45 minutes away. And they specialized in this thing called proton radiation, which is pinpoint radiation that goes right to your tumor. And they like to do it for young women because there's a lot less side effects and they don't have to do chemotherapy. So we found a way to get into this treatment facility, and we went there. And it, instead of just going to your normal place and getting it done, because this proton radiation was so pinpoint, we wanted to go there because we wanted to have another baby. We wanted to, you know, not let her go through chemo and all this other stuff. So we ended up going up there. So we had to leave at 5:30 in the morning every morning to drive up to Knoxville for this treatment. We get the treatment. We drive back down to Chattanooga. I drop her off. I'd make her lunch. And then I would go to plan practice with Coach McCall. We plan practice and we'd go right to practice. After practice, I'd go home. I'd play with our child to take her off my wife's hands for a little bit, make dinner, put the baby to bed, make sure that my wife was getting the emotional support that she needed, because I was so busy, it was hard for me to do that other than that hour and a half drive back and forth every day. and then I'd go to bed and wake up and do it again. So you asked me how I managed it. You don't really manage it. What you do is you just kind of put your head down and go and just pray that it works. And I was really fortunate at that time where my wife knew that I needed basketball to cope with what was going on, because I didn't even really give myself enough time to think about the end result if it was poor with my wife. I was just so focused on getting her healthy and coaching that I didn't have time to think about how bad it could be. And it was basketball really helped me get through that, that time period. And like, you know, you can't manage it. There is no managing it. It's just putting your head down and going through it, you know, and sometimes you can't even try to manage it because it's too hard.
Yeah. Like, I'm just picturing the craziness of getting up at 5:30, driving an hour and a half or whatever, going through treatment with your wife, bringing her back, getting her lunch, and then zooming to practice. Like, how hard was it to even be present and like really give your all in practice? I know you did the best you could or whatever, but like, was that a challenge to like mentally be there in practice? Or are you like got your phone near you, you know, making sure like half of your mind is on your wife that during those 2 hours?
Yeah. So it was hard. So what I really tried to do was I really tried to make sure that she was okay with me going to practice. Now, we didn't miss a practice or a game, and that's all my wife. That is all her being an absolute star and saying, I got it, go do this. I'll see you in a couple hours. But I would make sure after I drop her off at home, I'd make her a shake because she couldn't really eat anything. So I'd make her a shake and I'd talk to her and I'd look her in the eyes and I'd say, are you okay? Do you need me to stay any longer? What can I do? And just constantly be up her butt. So she would eventually say, no, I'm good. I need to sleep. I need to rest a little bit, go to practice. And that allowed me to have that clear mind for that 2.5-3 hours during practice. And the other thing that was really good, and this is kind of where basketball is so important in a coach's life, is the players at Chattanooga were amazing. Like, they knew I was going through stuff and they knew I had a lot on my plate, and they were hugging me, putting their arms around me. They were checking on me all the time, and they really helped me be able to give them all the attention they needed during that because they knew I needed a little bit. And I still remember like Justin Toyo, our center, like hugging me before every practice. Like, hey man, how's your wife? How you doing? You all right? You good today? And like, that's what I always did to him the year before. And it's just one of those things, like that's what makes basketball and coaching so magical and so amazing is that type of experience that you have.
Yeah, those definitely are the most like uplifting times when your kids lift you up. Was it hard to tell the team, or like how did you guys handle that?
So what I did was I told all the guys individually. I said, listen, my wife got diagnosed with cancer. I'm going to be around, but I don't know where this thing's going to go. And yeah, I just need you guys to just be there with me. And they were great. Like, they were all older. They were all more mature, and they really allowed me to do that. So I just kind of had individual conversations with them. And actually the kid, Rodney Chapman, that's at Dayton now, who's a really good player. He was a freshman for us at the time. And I was really close with his mom and dad through recruiting. And I called them and I told them, and they were such good people that they offered to, hey, they were from Atlanta. Hey, if you need me to come over and watch the baby for a little bit. So I kind of had all those interpersonal conversations with the guys one-on-one that really made it easy for me to just get into coaching. And they knew where I was coming from because it was such a personal thing that they understood the difficulty of the situation.
Okay, how long did like the treatments last? How long did this go on for?
So what we did was because we had to fight with the insurance company so much to get her this type of treatment, we didn't start the treatment until our first week of practice, and it was a 9-week treatment. So the timing of it was brutal because we started practice up, so we had no off days other than Sundays, and she wasn't getting the treatment on Saturday and Sunday. So we started 9 weeks straight every day, Monday through Friday. And we went all the way until I think the second week of the season. And then she was just in recovery mode until the season was over.
And now cancer-free for how many years?
Cancer-free 3 years. we got to go every 6 months for checkups, and then every 12 months we do a PET scan to make sure she's okay. But she's been good for 3 years, and we eat healthy. We take care of ourselves. We sleep a lot more now. We go to bed earlier. We're not binge watching Netflix. So we try to do everything we can to stay healthy after that experience.
That's amazing, man. Well, I don't know if congratulations is the right word, but I'm so happy for you and your family. And yeah, I guess it is congrats to you and your wife for 3 years cancer-free. Amazing.
Thanks, man.
I'm sure that feels better than any win or championship you've ever won.
No, that was the best. When she rang that bell the day, you know, you ring the bell when you're done your treatment. I mean, I cried more that day. And anyone that knows me, I'm Italian. I cry all the time. I cried more that day than any day I've been on this earth.
Okay, so I'd love to say that, like, that's the end of the story. Happy ending, right off into the sunset. but, of course, we get, you know, like, that stuff happens and your life keeps going on, like, while that's happening. So you're still, you know, in this crazy rat race of the coaching industry, and you guys do a great job there at Chattanooga and get the UMass job, right? So, like, how long after you guys finish treatment are you, like, packing up your bags and moving to Massachusetts?
Yeah, so we finished treatment in early December of that year, and then in mid-March we're moving to Amherst. So
crazy.
the biggest thing, Adam, that we were going through as a family was we loved that place that we got our treatment at. So we had to make some decisions on, okay, we're going to keep going to treatment there, but we're going to move up to Amherst. So we packed up the house, we moved to Amherst, and we still fly over to Knoxville, you know, every 6 months for checkups.
Wow. Okay. And then obviously UMass was a, you know, like rocky chapter or whatever. I don't know if it was rocky, but it ended rocky. And it, you know, obviously well documented, that the staff was all let go, the assistants, at least Matt's still there, and, but had to make a complete staff change. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Like, I don't know how much you're willing or able to talk about it on the podcast, but maybe talk at least about, you know, the emotions behind it and you know, what happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, the emotions behind it, and a lot of coaches, like, I think you and Kevin talked about this. Like, if you're in this thing long enough, you're going to get fired. And you just don't know when it's coming, and you don't know, you know, why it's coming a lot of times. And UMass was a really hard situation for me personally, because I invested so much into the relationships that I built there. And unfortunately, we all got let go as assistant coaches, and there was a major change in the direction that they wanted to go in as a program. And I'm sure any coach will understand this if they've been fired before. It's an embarrassing thing to go through, and it really takes a lot out of you, and you don't really know how to respond to it. And especially in a situation when the head coach stays, but the assistant coaches are let go, you don't even know how to answer the questions when people ask you what happened, because a lot of times you don't want to say anything poorly about what happened. You want to maintain the, you know, the good answer, the political answer. So you're really just trying to shield and protect your boss. And in my circumstances, I was really close with Matt. You know, he was in my wedding. I was in his wedding, and I wanted to protect him. So I made sure that everyone knew that he was not at fault for what happened. And I really felt like that was my, I owed him that, because he gave me a lot of different opportunities in coaching and gave me a lot of responsibility. So I wanted to make sure that I protected him in that situation. But you know, you're very embarrassed. You don't know what to do. I did not handle it well. I kind of went into a situation where I didn't really want to talk to a lot of people. And I kind of shut myself off after the initial wave of everything that happened. And I actually went to real estate school last summer. I got my real estate license in the state of Florida, and I was ready to get out 100%. I said, I can't do this anymore. And the friends that you make in coaching don't let you do that. If you really don't want to, and your heart's telling you not to, and you talk to those people that you're really close with, they won't let you quit. And Jesse Bopp, Reggie Witherspoon, you know, guys like that that I've worked with, that I was really close with, Ashley Howard, guys like that would call for advice. Dr. John Giannini, Benny Seltzer, Tim Buckley, Brian Baroni, those guys did not let me quit. They kept telling me, you got to keep going. Something's going to break. It's not the worst thing. You know, how would you approach it if you were a head coach and got fired? What are you going to do? So I was in the middle of taking real estate classes, miserable, sitting in the back of the class, miserable, had no interest in it. And I would just get these text messages from Jesse Bopp, like, hey, what are you doing today? Did you work out? You taking care of yourself? Or Reggie Witherspoon, thinking about you, something's going to break. Don't give up yet. And those were the text messages that I needed, that when I got out of myself and I got out of my feelings, inspired me to go to the Florida Coaches Clinic again, to go on a practice tour, to not give up on something that I had just sacrificed 14, 15 years of my life for. So it was really hard, the UMass thing, and how it ended was really hard. But what came from that was probably what I needed the most in my life, and that was to slow down, to put basketball in perspective, and to go back to the root of why you wanted to coach and what's important. And I think I found all those things kind of throughout this year and going on that coaching tour that really made me want to get back in and get to LaSalle and help out a great friend of mine and do anything that's needed to just try to help them win games. And I really come full circle, you know, back to why I got in coaching and why I'm willing to sacrifice so much to stay in it.
All right. So much to talk about. I want to get to the practice tour in a little bit, but let's go back to like dealing with getting fired. You mentioned embarrassed, which is a common one. I can relate. You know, like, and you're right, we talked about it. Me and Kevin talked about it on the previous podcast where he talked about getting let go from UAB. And he's still dealing with it. Is like, you want to, you know, there's days you want to just go into isolation and like not talk to anybody and, mm-hmm. you know, bury your head in the sand. But probably, you know, what you should be doing, at least professionally, is you probably should be more present and seen and heard. Mm-hmm. You know, you probably should be hitting up everybody you've ever met in coaching and just staying mm-hmm. in front of them. And you know, he called it staying in the middle of the ring, which I loved. But that's hard to do. And you do, there is like almost like a grieving process of getting fired, right? Like you're angry. You got to go through anger. You got to go through like upset. You got to go through like mm-hmm. depressed, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, did you feel like you needed that time to get over it before you could get back on your path?
Yeah. So what happened was when everything went down at UMass, it got out on the internet really fast. And you know, Twitter and these things, like they make up stories and they put your name out there and it gets really embarrassing. So what happened was when all that stuff went down, I started getting flooded with calls and text messages from people like, dude, are you okay? I heard what happened. How can I help? And again, I was so invested into protecting coach and to handling it the right way that I just handled that. And then when all that kind of settled down, I got to this place of embarrassment. I got to this place of complete, just alienation of people, just trying to recap what just happened. And I was not in a good place. Like I needed to grieve a little bit. I needed to say, this is what happened. And now I got to figure out what I'm going to do. Like I needed that time. And once I got through that period of like, of the grieving is when it started to come back. Like, yo, why do you want to coach? What is the driving force behind it? So yeah, man, it was embarrassing. It was hard. I needed the time to go through it. I needed the time to myself because you don't get a lot of time to yourself because you're dealing with so much when that happens.
I can't decide that if that instinct to protect your boss or your former boss in basketball or I guess in athletics is a good thing or a bad thing. You know, like it's definitely the right thing to do professionally. Like you can't go around mm-hmm. saying like, this is what happened and bashing people mm-hmm. like that is definitely mm-hmm. frowned upon and probably rightfully so. But like if you're mm-hmm. in corporate America and something messed up goes down, you get fired or whatever, like are you still protecting that company? Like I don't know if that's where like basketball is screwed up or maybe is that a good thing?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point. And like there's nothing that happens in college basketball that you can relate to like the corporate world. Like there's just nothing, you know, you get so many different things thrown at you that the normal person would think is absurd. And I think a lot of that is what you're saying with the coaching thing. And I, this is the way that I viewed it. And you got to do the right thing always. And it might not be what's best for you in the moment. And it might not scratch the itch of some of the anger that you're going through, but you've got to do what's right. And if you want to live as a person that, you know, shits on your boss or complains about everything or makes everything negative, then that's who you're going to be. And I decided to take the route of, you know what? I was really appreciative of Matt giving me the opportunity to coach. And he put, he was in a very difficult situation there and he had to do what he thought was right. And I wasn't going to, you know, shit on him to other people, Adam. I was going to say, you know what? He gave me the opportunity. I appreciate it. And now I'm going to go on to something else and I'm going to break off here and make it work. But I agree with you. Like there's a part of you that wants to tell everyone what happened. And then there's a part of you that says, no, I gotta do what's right here. And I gotta make sure that people know, you know, what happened wasn't necessarily on my boss.
Right. Yeah. There's a difference between like bashing and explaining, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you handled it the right way. And I'm not saying you should be going around bashing, the situation or anything like that. But it is like, I don't know. It's just a tricky one. I don't have the answer.
Yeah. It goes when you explain sometimes just because you're explaining it, a lot of times it comes off the wrong way. And that's right. Where I was running into. I was always on the defense, but I can never play offense when it came to getting jobs. Cause I was explaining. Yeah. And that's one of the, like you said, man, it's a tricky line there to decide what to do.
Yeah, it is. Part of me feels like, you know, is it messed up that our industry encourages you not to like stand up for yourself and instead protect the integrity of the people that just let you go? You know, I don't know. It is a hard one.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go down to Florida, you go to real estate school, your close circle of friends kind of pull you back to your purpose. And it sounds like you get a little bit reignited and ready to get back on the saddle, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned it. You go on a practice tour. Like what is that? What did you do? And like how did you get the idea to do it?
Yeah. So Dr. John Giannini and I spoke, and he said, "Hey, listen, your situation's really hard." And he's like, "I get it. And you're 33 and you're right in the middle of your coaching life." And he goes, "If you were a head coach, I would tell you to take the year, go to practices, see everyone that you can and get back in it in the spring." And I thought to myself, okay, I don't have a lot of money, but I got enough saved up. I've got tons of Marriott points saved up from 13 years of not going on vacation because of coaching. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this work. So I put my family with my mom in the Villages, Florida. And I just did it. And I just went and I went to every practice and I called everybody that I knew in the business. And they were so great to me in allowing me to come to their practice, sitting in the office, talking with them. And a lot of people knew my situation was very unique. So they felt bad. So a lot of people wanted me to come around to practice just to kind of be in a gym and get the feel of practice. So Giannini gave me the idea to do it. And then I talked to some people that I really trusted, and they said that they thought it would be very beneficial. So I started in Florida. I went to Furman on my way up, saw Jeremy Groh, who was a manager at Indiana when I was there. He's a great guy. And I drove up, and I went all the way up to New England, and just New England for a week, New York for a week, Philly for a week, D.C. for a week, Carolinas for a week, Georgia for a couple days, and then back to Florida. And I did that for a month and a half of just going to different practices. I was sleeping on couches. I slept, it's embarrassing, but I slept in my car two nights when I didn't have enough for the hotels. I used all my Marriott points that I could. I slept with some of my family members. They let me sleep on their couch. And it was the best thing I've ever done, Adam. And I tell anyone that goes through a tough situation to try and do this, because I learned so much in those 35 practices and it completely rejuvenated me. So what's funny, Adam, is everyone was saying, "Hey, I'm jealous of you, man. I'd love to do this. I'm jealous of you. I love that you get the opportunity to do this." And I'm like, "I don't have health insurance or money right now, but if you want to be jealous of me, I'll take it."
Yeah. What, Was that super stressful? I mean, the health insurance part, I didn't even think about that. Your wife is a cancer survivor. What were you guys doing?
So what we did was we took the unemployment money that we had, and we got health insurance through through Cobra, and we just got signed her up, and we got her the bare minimum health insurance for her and my child. And I went through the year without having health insurance, so I just was safe. You know, I just didn't do anything and just hope nothing happened. But we used that money to get her health insurance, and then I just kind of went about my own way for the rest of the year, just trying to avoid everything possible, stay healthy.
Crazy. What did you learn on that practice tour? Like, what were the big takeaways from it?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I learned was that, like, everyone has their way of doing it, and everyone's way of doing it is really good, but it's how you sell your way of doing it. Like, is everyone in your program connected to what the head coach wants? And if there's that buy-in, it doesn't matter if you're blitzing pick and rolls, downing pick and rolls, if you're sliding through pick and rolls, it doesn't matter what you do. It matters the buy-in level. And the best practices that I saw and the best coaches that I saw commanded the best buy-in from everyone in their program. And it was really interesting to see, like, Jay Wright for 2 days run a practice, and the attention that he had whenever he would speak during practice, and the control that he had of practice, and the buy-in that he had in practice. And he did something, and Coach Howard does this now at LaSalle, and I think this is fascinating, is he'll say eyes. And the second that he says eyes, everybody in the program stops what they're doing and focuses on the head coach. And there's no chatter and there's no distraction. He's got the whole entire room. And it's just little things like that that I took that really stood out to me. Just pretty much you can do anything, but if your buy-in is really good and your execution is really good because of the buy-in, you can be really good at it.
Is this, what would your advice to someone who just got let go or is just trying to find a job, whatever the situation, like, would you recommend doing one of those practice tours?
Yeah, so I look back on it, and if I could have done one thing last spring that I should have done is I should have gone and worked for an AU team. I should have been around good players. I should have called some of the guys in this business that I really trust from an AAU standpoint and gone and helped them for the spring and summer. And if I would have been able to do that, I feel like I could have stayed in the mix a little bit in recruiting. And I think, you know, keeping yourself in the middle of the ring is the best way that I've heard anyone say it. Like, if you can just stay involved in recruiting and stay active, that's going to help you. And then the second part to that would be if you come through the spring and summer and you don't have a job, and you can afford financially to go do a practice tour, I would dive in on that, because you're going to learn so much. You're going to stay in front of so many different people, and you're going to become so much more aware of how other programs do things. It'll take you out of your little bubble that you've been in where, for whoever you've been working for.
And did it lead to a job for you, or no, the job came while you were on the tour?
Yeah, so what happened was I went to LaSalle 3 times because of my relationship with Ash, who's one of the best people in the business, genuine, a good guy, good leader, good coach. He does the Villanova stuff so well. And I went there 3 times, and I watched their practice on a Saturday morning, on a Friday afternoon, and then the next week again on a Wednesday. And I was just around. I was just talking to him about his team. I was talking to him about the Atlantic 10. I was asking him how he did certain things, and we just kind of rekindled our relationship that we've had over the years. And when he had this spot come open a week before the season, he called me and was like, "Hey, I don't even know if you want this, but I've got something if you want it for the year." And because I trust him, because I love him, because he's like family, I didn't even think. I just told my wife, "Hey, I'm going to LaSalle for the year." She was a rock star. And I just got back in the car and drove right up there and made it to practice and started helping.
And that was what, August?
So that was, I started the tour in late August, and he called me in late October. So from late August till mid-October, I was on the practice tour. And then I just got back down to Florida, and that's when he called me, and I drove back up there.
So what were you going to do like that year? So you're October, you don't have a coaching job, I mean, were you going to do the real estate deal for a year and then try to get back in, or what was the plan?
Adam, my month in real estate class was maybe the worst month I've ever been through. So there was no shot of me going back to doing that. That's for sure. I couldn't even bear to sit in that thing for another day. So what I was going to do was, when the practice tour was done, I was going to kind of take a couple weeks, and then I was going to turn November, December, and January. I was going to do the same thing practice tour wise, but for high schools and junior colleges. So I was going to go and see as many players as I could from Florida up to the East Coast and just go evaluate kids, build lists, go see all my friends in AAU, go see all my friends in high school, and just spend time with those guys and do the same thing. And the plan was to do that until about early February. And then I was going to take February and March and recircle back with some of the programs that I wanted to go watch again. And what happened was, I got really close with some of these coaches, and I said, I'd love to see how your practice is in February. And they'd say, all right, come back. Spend a couple of days with us. Watch us, see how we get prepared for the league. You know, Mike Rhodes at VCU was like, come for the weekend. Watch us. Stay for film if you want. So it was great. Like, I was going to do that again in February and March and kind of see how teams prepared and got ready for the end of conference play. And then hopefully that would lead up to the job cycle, which the coronavirus has put into a screeching halt.
Yeah. So how are you navigating that? I mean, you do have a job, right? LSL, or was that just the one you're doing? Okay.
No,
so
I'm
you're
working still... with Ash. He's been great. He's been great.
So at least you have something. But what would you tell people who don't have something or need a job right now in the coaching world with coronavirus going on? Like, any thought to how you would attack that?
Yeah. So my thought process right now is, I don't think anyone can do much of anything. And I think that if you try so hard, because this is so against our nature, Adam, to sit at home and not do a lot. But if we try to make something where there's not right now, I think we can rub some people the wrong way. So if you're a young coach and you really want to try to get into this thing and you're trying to search, now there's a difference between trying to get a GA job or as opposed to an assistant job, but there's not a lot of movement right now. So I just think the best thing that you can do right now is just check in on everybody on a regular basis that you're close with, and check in on every coach, AAU coach or high school coach that you're close with, in just a casual way of checking in on them. And then if something opens, then your opportunity can come and you can attack it. But there's just not that much that you can do right now. And again, it's so against our nature as coaches to sit back and wait. But, you know, the virus is kind of dictating our timeline, not as much as the coaching carousel.
Yeah, there really is. That really is all you can do, right? Just check in and work the phones.
That's it. And just check, see how people are doing. See how people are handling this thing, making sure people are safe, because there's literally nothing else that you can do right now.
Crazy. Pete, what other advice would you give to you know, people trying to navigate this profession?
Yeah, I just think there's no straight line in coaching. So whether, you know, you work for a Hall of Fame guy or you're a D2 guy like us or you're a junior college coach, I just don't think you can compare your situation to anyone else's. And I think that, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. And the more that you try to compare your career to others, the less of an opportunity you have to find yourself. And I think that there's going to be a lot of stuff that gets thrown at you as a coach. And your lessons that you learn from coaching, you have got to apply to your real life. If I didn't work for Coach Donovan, if I didn't work for Dr. John Giannini, if I didn't work for Tom Crean, there's no way that I could have found the treatment center for my wife, plowed through it, stayed on the phone, be relentless, and get her the treatment that she needed to get her out of that safe. So that's my advice for young guys and just anyone in this thing, is just stay with it, stay relentless. Use the tools that basketball and coaching gives you, and don't compare yourself to anyone. And eventually it'll crack one way or another.
Yeah, such good advice. Comparison is the thief of joy. Is that a Billy Donovan quote? Where'd you get that one? That's great.
I don't know. I think it's just something I might have read on John Rothstein's Twitter one day or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, it's good. Really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pete, man, I really appreciate you sharing your story. You've been through so much, I know it's only a matter of time before you're back on the road, which I know is where you want to be, because you are one that lives for the hustle, it seems like. So I know it's hard to be in the office, and it's hard for all of us to be, like you said, sitting still during this coronavirus time, but excited to see what's in store for you, my man.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. You guys are doing a great thing, and I think that what you guys are doing with this and what you guys are doing with Rising Coaches is so important to get in early. I wish I would have been more dialed into this when I was 24 rather than chasing nonsense, because I look at what you guys are able to do and the connections that you guys have been able to make to each other and how you help each other. And that's what you need in this business, especially when you go through a really hard time. And, you know, Andy Farrell gave me the advice to just continue to read when you're in a really bad spot. And I've read more books this year than I ever did. And it's just that kind of stuff that helps you get through a lot of hard times. So you guys are doing a great thing. I love following you guys, man. And anyone that's out there that's listening that doesn't have a membership, you should get it, because it's going to help you when it's your hardest time.
No, I appreciate it, Pete. Yeah, and we talked about it before we started recording today, is like, there's not, you know, this business is so hard, and where's the support system? You know, what's the organization that's there to help lift you up? Fortunately, you were able to have that support system through personal relationships that you made through all your stops. But, you know, there's a lot of people who weren't as fortunate to work at so many different programs and have those friendships. So yeah, that's just all we're trying to do is, you know, be there, for everyone. Because this business is hard, man. It's really hard.
It's unpredictable. Life's hard. It's unpredictable, and you need that. And like, there's no one that's coaching the coaches. And that's one of the things that you guys are doing. And I think as all of us coaches need to do more of, is just helping each other more and being there for each other more. And I think it'll parlay for whoever's throwing the helping hand out.
Well, Pete, thanks again, man. Really, really enjoyed it.
Appreciate you, man. Be safe. Stay inside.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. Just a quick reminder, please write us a review and subscribe, and please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com.